Tov, good afternoon. Just a few brief words for Chanukah. And, you can approach Chanukah from many different perspectives. However, being here in Gush Etzion and being in Shvat is there, I think one perspective which is important that we emphasize. The basin with Amisrael. Am Yisrael has had many achievements, many accomplishments during the past 2,000 years. One thing that we lacked for close to 2,000 years was the ability to establish a political state, land of our own, to have the zchut to defend ourselves against Goyim. Ever since Churban Bayit Sheni, or if you want from Post Bar Kokhba, has been wandering, being buffeted by various historical forces, being entertained more or less by going in different lands, to a large degree even the experience that most of you represent from your home countries, maybe a galut of convenience and of comfort, but nevertheless remains a galut. The ability to defend yourselves, to establish to engage Mesirut Nefesh from Israel in Eretz Israel is something that certainly has not been around the past 2,000 years. And Gush Etzion, to a large degree, is very much geographically and historically engaged in such a malach. If you know, towards Migdal Oz, there's a cave of Bar Kokhba's period, which they found letters from Bar Kokhba's warriors. You go down towards Beit Shemesh, the Tzomet Ha'ilah, you go through Emek Ha'ilah, David HaMelech, the whole highway which near the satellites, David HaMelech was busy finding the Plishtim over there. And of course, Karmei Tzur, Elazar, connect directly to the Maccabim. Some of the battles of the Maccabim were in this area. And, Elazar is named after such a battle, Karmei Tzur is named after such a settlement. When you come and you have Yeshivat Hesder, and Yeshivat Hesder is based upon the idea that you take your own historical destiny in your hands, that you're willing to commit to have Mesirut Nefesh, that you're willing to not only engage in Torah, but to engage in furthering our historical fortunes and destiny. That's what Parachanak is all about. It's not only the Nes Pach Hashem per se, and the Kedusha, and Torah, which are all beautiful things. Take it to Pach Yitzchak and Chanukah. It's a wonderful book, creative, original, fascinating. But the theme that goes through Chanukah is that Chanukah is only Torah Shebaal Peh, and the history is almost non-existent. So maybe some of the Zionist movement, maybe you got to one to the other extreme, spoke about the Maccabim and not about the Torah. But Yeshivat Hesder is trying to combine Torah and Eretz Yisrael, Torah and Tzavah, of course. And it's part of the experience that you should try to expose yourself to, feel it. I'll be honest. My dear father, Lo Shalom, was born in Poland in 1898. When he saw a policeman in his youth, the basic point was to escape or to hide as fast as possible. He came here, he'd see policemen on the street, he would hug them, or almost, just about hug them. And of course they didn't know what he wanted, but the point was that a Jewish policeman, a Jewish soldier, is something to say Shechianu about. It's something which was non-existent. Baruch Hashem, he had many grandchildren who served in the army afterwards. I can't describe to you the pride and the emotions that he had about the zchut that he escaped from the Nazis with the last boats that left Europe in 1941, escaped mamash at the last minute, his grandchildren, many of them served in the army, many of them were Kembenei Torah, who were also Chayalim. I can't describe to you, there are many experiences which you may have in chutzas that the Israelis lack, and that's a topic for Sichot to Israelis, but some of the, I can't describe to you what it means to be able to to put on a uniform of Tzahal, go to the border, and to realize or to feel to act out of a sense, not only that someone is supervising you, but out of a sense that Baruch has put you here to defend Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael is delegated to the responsibility of fighting for Am Yisrael, and the satisfaction of following the footsteps of Yeshua Binun, of David HaMelech, Yudah Maccabi. Think of us Friday afternoon from Tachana Kazit home, and to see all the kids playing in Gula Mesharim, and to feel that they're playing there because you're responsible for that, because you are willing to protect them the whole year round, or the whole week round, to have a sense, really going in the foot of David HaMelech, reading Tehillim through the prism of common experiences David HaMelech had, you know, being on some rooftop in Gaza or in the border, or being in the border and looking, you know, 1,000 meters, 2,000 meters across the border, and seeing the Arab armies, and be fully aware that if you're not over there, the next thing they do is get in their tanks and start crossing the border. But they don't, because you know you're there. Tefillat Shacharit, Yichidut, but in the sense, what's more, of saying having all Jewish history behind you and front ahead of you is it's uplifting, and that's what Hanukkah is all about. It's trying to realize the importance, the willingness. The Maccabim, we're talking about Mesirut Nefesh, the willingness to put their lives on the line, who's the sacrifice. The willingness to put Am Yisrael and the Kodesh Baruch Hu ahead of their own private fortunes, they could be much more comfortable and better for them to simply join the Mit Yavnim. And it's this sense of Am Yisrael and its history that that Chanukah is, that was to tap into the sense of not only the Torah within it, but also the commitment to Jewish history and the Mesirut Nefesh, to realize that. I'll conclude with after Lebanon war, I was doing Lebanon, and one day there was some kind of exercise, and like two vadiyot which met together at a fork, and the fork met, and this was a shiur from me, okay? The army asked Rishon Rabbanim to come and visit soldiers. There was a shiur there from me. He 65 years old, a nice white beard with hajat panim, and he stood in this bluff overlooking. Overlooking this fork between the two vadiyot, and Kitzur, all the tanks were streaming down. Here was this old Yiddish, Yiddish Jew. He looked like Eliyahu Navi, this old Jewish person looking, gazing into the future, and it was like at a movie. It was like this like seeing this old person looking into the future, knowing that that people willing to. To fight for Am Yisrael's fortunes and to do it in the name of Torah and Jewish history, it was uplifting. And that's, I think, that's when Chanukah, Gush Etzion, Yishvat Hesder, we should remember that perspective as well, and not only the Sufganiyot and the Levivot and other such things. So I promised to be brief today, so I hope I was. Bekasha.
I'm trying to.
Scan, yeah. Okay. What?
I live in Illinois in America, so what do I do about lighting? I'm flying over the line.
What are your options? I mean, you don't. If you're on light, the plane to Vakasha, you know. I just don't see what the options are.
Does
it mean
anything to get my parents back
in the scary to light for me? I think it does, but you know, it's a May. It's like this, and normally, if a Hamesh Chorach says that Bachrei Shiva are different than, but why don't you lie here and then travel? You know, why don't you lie here before you leave?
I'm living here before the day, like lunchtime, yes, and getting
there. Okay, listen, tomorrow, I think the Shur Kali tomorrow is about Shlichut in Chanukah, so listen to Shur Kali every day. Anyway, if you're not Pesach, come on out, I'll talk to you about it privately later on.
Sefer HaMakabim, there are two reasons mentioned for why we celebrate a day of Chanukah. One, because of the
reasons giving you
speak for what was the first? I missed the first one.
Why?
The first reason. Okay.
So why are those the reasons given in Sefer HaMakabim, and why the absence of the miracle of the candle of Hanukkah, and how are we supposed to relate to that?
Okay, in a sense, I think your last question answers the first. Look, why those are the reasons, presume that's what they thought. In other words, I wasn't there, but what's important is the following point. The reason we, I don't know what they did, the reason we celebrate Hanukkah is not because some history book has a report of what happened then. Even if, no matter what the book is, including Sefer HaMakabim, the reason we celebrate it is because Jewish tradition has adopted it, and Chazal took it as, made it part of our Masoret, Halacha, whatever. The reason I celebrate Hanukkah is not because Sefer HaMakabim reports anything. The reason I do it is because the Gemara says there's a Takana, and we have a constant, uninterrupted Masoret from there, which entered into the mainstream of Jewish experience. Tomorrow morning you would find a manuscript of some other such book, Sefer Shushan or whatever, which described Purim. It might be a very interesting historical source. If you find the Dead Sea Scrolls, as for history, it's extremely important. But not for history, but for the reason that we are obligated and that we observe and that we, if you want, our brit with the Kodesh Baruch Hu runs through, not through the Masoret, because we are not trying to recreate history, we're basically trying to establish a relationship in the present. The relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu exists at the moment, and of course, it's just a moment because it's gone through a whole course of events, but as the relationship has existed and developed and evolved and so on through 2,000 years. And this relationship is the way, I don't know if that's the word, it's called traditional Torah or whatever. In other words, Am Yisrael has acted throughout. So therefore, whether people at the time thought it was because of Sukkot or not, it may very well be that they did it as Tashlumin for Sukkot. But nevertheless, as before, it's not it's historical source, meaning it's descriptive. It's telling what happened in the past. It's not prescriptive, meaning why I should do it. The reason I should do it is because Moreh Shabbos says so, and because so the angle, the perspective we've adopted is that. And it holds true for halach in general. Tomorrow morning you'll find some new manuscript of a various Rishonim. It won't change halacha. And the Chazon Ish had his own reasons for this. I find it difficult to agree with the rationale he said, but the basic point of the thing is true. The Rebbe said to me when Levine in the 30s proud of Tzar Gaonim, so he told the Rebbe to revolutionize halacha because there'll be so many new shittas from Gaonim and the like that everything have to be revised in light of what the Gaonim thought. The Rebbe said to him, Lomi Nev, Lomi Tzatei. And of course he was right, and the reason he was right is because halacha is a process which evolves, and so it's not only because the Gaonim let's put it this way, but in the time of the Rambam we're probably greater than the Gaonim also, but that's not the real issue. The real issue is because discovering a source which has not been part of the mainstream, it's been interrupted and has gone underground and disappeared, that's a part of the halachic tradition. She give you a nice shir klali. Now, it eventually may be absorbed. 200-300 years from now, all those people may be reabsorbed, and then we'll be part of the mainstream, and they'll have its halachic relevance and significance. And I think I can point out certain shittot that's going to happen already. But broadly speaking, it's about halach, and for the same reason. Halach is not trying to figure out what was thought 1,200 years ago. It's rather what's... we are holding at the moment based upon what's happened to us over the past 1,200 years. For example, take a better example, think about the Siddur. You can go to the Gneis and find all kinds of beautiful piyuti. So as history, it's important and enlightening, and if you read the Gneis and compare it and contrast it to some of our contemporary tefillot, it can be, like all the history, it can be very enlightening. But what you're not going to do is you're not going to take your siddur and cut out, you know, so you find a period in the Geniza you like it better, you find the Nusach HaShemana Esri you like better than the current Nusach, you're not going to take it out and replace it with the Geniza. The reason is because Tefillah is a dialogue between man and God, Am Yisrael and Kadosh Baruch Hu, and the dialogue has to follow the way it's evolved and not what it was, not where it was in the past. It's through relationships between people. If you didn't meet them for 12 years, you can't go back to where you were. You have to somehow pick up where you're at the moment, and so on and so forth. So that's why, whether or not, why they thought so in the past, I guess the answer is a question for historians, but if I were to view the historical source, that's what Sefer Makkabim is. It's a historical source at the end, and it's not a source which shaped, was not a formative influence in the mainstream tradition. That's where it's that's the matter. That's not what's the crucial point for us at the moment. Now, whether or not you do take some mainstream sources, they talk about Chokat HaMishkan, they talk about the Milchama, talk about Nespach HaShemen. So those, all those are somehow integrated into our Chanukah experience. Sukkot, for Yom Benu, given enough drashot, so eventually Sukkot will be integrated into it also. But at the moment, it's good for drashot, it's not going to at the moment shape how we celebrate Chanukah. We got the last question regarding the second one. I think the crucial element here is not Neis Pach HaShemen versus the. And versus the Milchama, vice versa. The crucial point, and that would require much longer and more elaborate halachic and machshavah discussion, is the following. The crucial element of Chanukah is the Brit which Chanukah represents. In other words, at the end of the day, Yomim Tovim, the basic idea of Yomim Tovim are Brit. A covenant between Amisrael and Kadosh Baruch Hu, a bit between man and God. It was true in Pesach. It's true in Chanukah. It's true in Purim. Hadur Kiblu B'Mei Chashverosh. It's true almost of all Chagim. It was Lifnei Hashem. That's what creates and makes a Chag into a Chag. You can be Lifnei Hashem for various reasons. We don't celebrate miracles. Look in Pesach. Shrish of Pesach is a greater miracle than the first day of Pesach. But the idea is not celebrate miracles. If I talked about Yisrael before, in Muhammad Yeshua, so you have Beit Choron, rocks fell out of the sky. We don't celebrate that. There's no Yom Tov to celebrate the fact that Kadosh Baruch Hu overturned nature. Because Yomim Tovim and Chagim don't deal with the God-nature relationship. They deal with the God-man relationship. Now, the God-man relationship doesn't work through miracles. It works through covenant. It works through relationship. It works through dialogue. Elamai, that history and miracle at times express a relationship. In other words, the importance of these things, whether you win or lose in battle, whether you rescued Chaz Shalom not, whether it's a miracle, is the miracle, it has everything. It's all about. In other words, a miracle really means divine intervention. Now, divine intervention, it's mostly important because why does it intervene? Because of a relationship. It's either to reestablish a relationship, it's either to express a relationship, and the like. So therefore, what's crucial is the following. What's crucial is, A, belief in miracles, b'chlal. In other words, the ability that Kadosh Baruch Hu controls nature and is involved in the world, that's one cardinal belief. And the other one is that, and I'll say this now, and the other point is that these miracles, see, their importance is usually not in solving a problem. Right? Their importance is in the willingness to employ them. For instance, the Rambam thought that using miracles is a bad idea. A miracle means the system is lacking something. It's, if you have to intervene, if you have a computer, the program is not running smoothly, you intervene. If the program is running smoothly and properly, there's no need for any intervention. The program is doing it all on its own. So miracles, in a sense, prove that there's a deficiency in the program. More or less. However, if you have a problem and someone's willing to come in the middle of the night to fix it for you, that reveals a relationship. So in other words, the willingness to override the system is crucial. The willingness itself is more important than actually overriding the system. Now, whether this is done through milchama, whether it's done through the nes, either way, the idea of Chanukah is really reaffirming the relationship between Israel and the Kodesh Baruch Hu in light of the fact that the whole Hellenistic movement and the Itzavinut called all this into question. The beat was called into question. The covenant was in doubt, and that's a crucial point. Now, some sources express this through the Bat Masechet Shabbat. Others express it through the Milchama. Deep down, though, they both have the same idea of Chanukah, which is that it's reaffirming, reestablishing this relationship. Now, it could be that if you talk about the Milchama, there's an additional element as well. So we also celebrate the fact that we rescued and that we're not, because Baruch Hu rescued us. But that's element number two, therefore, whether there are different traditions, or whether there are different emphasis upon one and upon the other, I'm not saying it's irrelevant, it has relevance. But it's not really a crucial point about Chanukah, well, I knew that here at least. Over what? When they first began, there's a big debate here whether in the first year the Kol Gavash actually boycotted them. Kavyachal subtly, in practice, not too subtly. Look, there's always this tension between Tmidim Kisidram and Musafim Kilchatam. Or, I'll put it like this. There is and was a certain, when I was in Yeshiva at your age, Chanukah was a regular week. In other words, the yeshiva was in session until Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You know, there's regular shiyomi Friday. But the thing was Shabbos Chanukah, the yeshiva was closed. But the shiyomi was Friday 8:30 as usual, and 10:30 people went home. Now, it was not even Shabbat Chofshit. Now there's a certain beauty to that. It's like a certain business-like. Seriousness, which has certain beauty to it. Maybe austere, but it's beautiful. On the other hand, there's also something nice and special about making, by having some variety and making things change. So that's if you want, in one level, do you want the beauty of consistency and routine? You know, there's really a certain beauty. It's much more impressive. It's restrained. The 13 parim and 14 kvasim and first day sukkos and 48 kiyot and on the other hand, there's also a value, of course, to that. There's also a second agenda, which I think in the last few years is somewhat been lost in the shuffle, or it's changed its focus a bit. I'll say it like that. There are many topics which are, I think, important to have some Torah knowledge about. But in our normal course of study, for various reasons, we don't come across them. In other words, without giving here a long sicha about the value of Iyun and the centrality of Iyun and so on and so forth, Iyun is geared, the moment you choose Iyun as your central vehicle of learning, so there's a certain inner dynamic or inner logic to Iyun. So you choose certain asechtot, certain sugyot, certain focuses. Now for some topics, it works wonderful. When you say Kiddushin, broadly speaking, when you first learn Kiddushin in Yeshiva, you go to a wedding, you understand exactly what's happening, you know all the basics, you know more than everything, you understand the background, you understand the context, and it's very little going Kiddushin that you'll not have been exposed to when you study the rest of Kiddushin and you go to a wedding. In other topics, it's really not like that. The various topics which either don't appear in Shas and came up later on, or in the sugars we study, for instance, this year and less so, but in previous years when we studied Gittin, we definitely left Zion onwards. So it meant that we didn't touch upon any of the topics which are really the, you know, if you want, the hot topics of Gittin nowadays, meaning Kfiyat HaGet, Agunot, all that in the past, because we touched upon. This year we changed, we did the ninth parak instead. But there are still many topics which we never get around to discussing, which we feel are pretty, I think it's important for Ben Torah to have some kind of knowledge of them, A, and B, it's, I also think people appreciate that they have some knowledge. The first few years, they were mostly halachic topics, which, about, if you want, contemporary halachot, which, have not, which you don't come across. For instance, first year was about, if I remember, transplants. It was 1 year was about Chilul Shabbat in case of Piguim. Things along those lines. And I still think that, you know, we should either try to balance the Mayun again and try to occasionally do something like, for instance, I don't think we've ever touched fertility issues halachic. Even though it's halachic lemaisa, it's one of the most crucial areas at the moment. For the 50% of the population who needs it, but the need is crucial. It's not, you know, it's not like you know it's whether or not he light candles you know at night. It's okay. It's chashuv, but it's nothing like whether you have a child or not. But the thing is, they're not sugyot. So to do that, you have to deal with from a different perspective than we normally do. Right, we did transplants that time. It was the same thing. It was for the line in the Gemara, you're not going to have any clear understanding of what to do. You have to read the tshuvas of the late 20th century. It was known in the 19th century in Kalachom, the 12th century, it was like a tshuva transplant because it's like writing a tshuva nowadays where the Marshal is a chayvit tefillin. So the answer is, no one's going to write it until a Marshal knocks on the door and asks for the answer. And I'm serious, you know, the Seder Shul will not be written until someone needs an answer. And I think we should go back to that model and at least have some of that, Aleph. In the meantime, though, we evolved to choose other topics which we also don't deal with systematically, but we should, or at least it's important to deal with them also. Now, for instance, last week's about, if I remember, the attitude towards going. It's an important topic, you know, and it's important in Chutzlars for its reasons, it's important here in Israel for its reasons, it's important in Bichlal. To try to take something and do something more systematically, which is off our radar normally, but it's important that we should have a vehicle to address these issues, I think it's a good idea. Plus, there's also the added benefit of being exposed to other people, not listening to the same Shei Shiva, the same answers to all the questions, you know, being exposed to others as well. What bothers me is with the current format, unless you decide to devote 2 days to one topic, so then, you know, which then you can do it more seriously and more thoroughly. The moment that the way is the moment, every session is a different topic, they're all in the broad umbrella, but they all have some different topic, it's very diffuse. In other words, put differently, it's a you can't really, you know, get down to the root of these issues. And we say we'll bring three speakers, put them on a panel, and give each one 20 minutes. And then, they'll argue among themselves for another 20 minutes. Now, all these topics, these topics are much more significant. They demand much more qualifications, they demand a much better time frame. So I'd rather have less topics. You know, if we're going to talk about leadership. I'd rather focus on one element and stick to that rather than go, you know, five different models or whatever. Each model will get half an hour or whatever. But, that's always the problem with these. There's a famous joke that every Easter has an Easter of Chatzis Shiur. So what's the Chatzis Shiur of Bitul Torah? Reading and learning. There was the Beverly mood. It's because it's talking learning is not really to learn. It's to talk about a topic from above. It's not it's not really to analyze it, a topic. And this also, it's in that regard, it's I think it's a bit a bit from the surface, and it'd be better to do it deeper. But that's the rationale. But if you want to make Josh and learn Gita, you're welcome.
Does it have to be about something?
No.
talking about Mamzerim, or what happened with David and Bathsheba to their son. How do we reconcile that? It's not them that's actually doing something wrong.
It's not
what? Getting punished for it. The children, like David and Bathsheba's son, or Mamzerim.
So first of all, the question, you know, was that what, in a sense, was asked by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says in Masechet Yevamot, "Uvat yochal litka." That's a. The truth, of course, is that if you view it as a punishment, I think you can't reconcile it. The question always is whether you should be as a punishment, or if you want some kind of, reality. First, I mean, I'll qualify that answer in a moment. But broadly speaking, mamzerut is not a moral flaw of the child, of the parents, yes, but not of the child. And therefore, Chazal said, this is clear cut. Mamzer talmid chacham, kodem mikohen gadol ha'aretz, yikarai mipininim, yikarai mikohen gadol shechaz lefnayi lifnim. Mamzer talmid chacham. It takes precedence over Kohen Gadol Am Haaretz, and the point is because Mamzer, he has no there's no moral flaw, and he can be a wonderful person. It's perceived most probably as a metaphysical issue. For instance, I remember someone told the Rav that he described him some kind of woman's menu or whatever. So he said to the Rav, and you know. The woman even, you know, we said, the Russia, what does that mean? So he said, well, the woman got Leah, they died, whatever. And they even duchen. So at that point, he laughed. Not about any of the previous things. Why? Because he said, they're not Kohanim. And that, so okay, you could argue whether a woman is a Kohen or not. If you want, Mechaschinuch, Asman Darais and others discuss the topic. But then he said, look, well, he said, I'm not a Kohen either. In other words, the Gra wasn't a Kohen, but the shoemaker in his shul was a Kohen, would bench him. In other words, so what's the point? The point is that Kahuna and Levia, as being a Kohen of Israel, is not a question of achievement, or converse, of moral achievement, or moral flaw, religious achievement, or religious error. If that's the case, so the Gra would be a Kohen, and the shoemaker would be Israel. Or whatever. The point is, it's seen as almost a metaphysic rooted in Yochsin, however you understand the concept. And therefore, so the Gra is Israel, and Rabbeinu Tam was got Shlishi and not Rishon. However, when you come to ask yourself who has greater value, who is or whatever, who do you value more? So obviously the grow with a person who just, you know, his parents made him into a Kohen. So I think this is the same is true here as well. In other words, the individual achievement relates to the individual. Metaphysical status is a different story. So it impacts upon his ability to marry. I'm not trying to minimize the problem. But it's that I think is broadly speaking the answer. The other point is, I think halacha, even though this is not so familiar to our modern ears, halacha often looks at a person not as an individual. You're not an atomic individual, you know, disassociated from your past and your future. There's a perspective that a person is part of a larger entity. It's probably the same issue. So there are various discussions about how do you reconcile Lom Tu Avot Al Banim, Poked Avon Avot Al Banim. Some of the answers say that indeed Poked Avon Avot Al Banim, under certain qualifications, Bochzim Asa Avotayim Bidayim. But why is that? You know, it doesn't say though. You know, it's like this: if the son is a sinner and he follows in the footsteps of his parent, he will pay for the parent's errors as well. You're not saying he's paying for his own sins. Because the assumption is that there really is an entity, be it on the national level, be it on the family level, which transcends the individual and relates to past and future generations. That's why. That's why, for instance, the idea of Yerusha, the sugars of Yerusha are predicated upon this idea. Yerusha is not simply a question of dispensing with money. It's a question of perpetuating a legacy. I think Psul Eidus has something to do with this also. Yipasul Eidus, loim tu avot abanim, beidut avot, loim tu banim, and vice versa. Because the family is seen as a single entity. The idea of Yibum is based upon that idea. That it's one bayit. The bayit is all the brothers. Korban Pesach is based upon that. Sometimes it works horizontally, all the brothers. Sometimes it works vertically. And part of the reason that we say often, Vidvadu et avonam et avon avotehem. Or avotenu chatum ve'enam. Why? Because from a certain degree we are one unit. With the unit of Am Yisrael or Shevet Yudah, whatever. And so there is, in a sense, in other words, that the child is not simply born individually or alone. And that he really is a continuation and part of the entity that his parents created, or that he's continuing his parents. So I think that's also part of the. Part, if you want, of the perspective, but at the end, the basic point remains that muvat lo chalit kom, the parents have to wear their consequences, but for the child, it's psul chitum. It's not a chesed kedushas Yisrael. It's an iser has to do with yichus. It's a problem with his yichus. The same way there being ever there's a problem, being a ger has this, and there are various issues with yochsin. It's a yochsin issue, and the personal level. Mimzer Tamit Chacham, Kodem Kohen Gadol Am Haaretz. You can ask about all Musar, not only the reason Musar movement. I would answer yes, broadly speaking. I think the Rambam certainly thinks so. You have to make a basic decision. Do you view all of... No, it's, do you view Torah simply as narrowly concerned with what the Baruch Hu said? The difference between Musar and Halacha is twofold. One is the subject matter. In other words, Halacha tells you what to do, and the like, and Musar tries to restrict around with a human being. Or Musar deals with the soul. Halacha prescribes to you what to do based upon the Baruch Hu's authority. Number two is who's the speaker, so to speak, or who's the author? Is it Kodesh Baruch Hu himself, or is it human thoughts? So you could, in theory, if you want, make these claims that Talmud Torah itself is only Mamash Kadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, authored, be it himself or the development of what he said through Jerusalem Altair. In the Gemara Brachos by the Fidalos by Birkas Torah, there are such opinions regarding Birkas Torah. We talk about Sherba Asher Natanam Torah Temet, specifically Natanam Torah Temet, only about things which are actually Torah in the more severe sense of the phrase. But the Rambam at least thinks that anything to do with nature, philosophy, and the like is considered Talmud Torah. There's a lot of that in paragraph of Talmud Torah. And with Ben Azai said, Zeh Sefer Todot Adam, Zeh Klal Gadol Torah, that the Torah takes interest in the human person, the human personality, the human human life, human activity. And the Musar movement is A, trying to understand the human personality, B, it's trying also to guide it, and to guide it in towards Torah Mitzvah. So, I tend to think it is Talmud Torah. However, I think to say Musar only, Musar all day long, will be an imbalanced diet. You know, like I would say, look, protein is food and carbohydrates are food. You can't eat only one. You have to balance your diet. So Musar may be Torah, but nevertheless, you have to balance it with other elements as well.
What does the Rosh Yeshiva think about the several Rabbanim that have decided not to say Shalos Ani Isha, the bracha in the morning?
I understand the motivation. I think they're misguided. In other words, I understand where they're coming from. I understand what's disturbing them. But nevertheless, I don't think they should be turned with a siddur. And number two, that's number one. Number two, I don't get here in the. It's like this, the very least, when I was your age, Nagib, had this romantic notion that men and women are the same. That is, no, they're equally created. You know, I grew up, I got married, and I have a few daughters. I realized that they're not quite the same. I'm not talking about metaphysics, I'm talking psychologically. There was the different experiences, the different approach to life differently, they experience life differently. Of course, I just give you a tragic example. A few years ago, I was in the States on a visit, and someone gave me a ride from Long Island to New Jersey. Be'erich, after half a mile, so the wife began to say to the husband, "There's not enough gas. We're gonna run out of gas." And the husband says, "Don't worry, there's plenty of gas. We can go to Pennsylvania like this." And of course, you know, every 10 minutes, you know, she nudges him in the elbow, and he says, "Plenty of gas." And you know, finally, we know, and they're somewhere near Manhattan, so they said, "What do you think?" I said, "It's a well-known male-female issue." And of course it is. I remember when my whole childhood, my parents had the same argument. You know, certain things are, you know, kachaze, you know, certain things are always like that. And it's a minor example, but I can give you much more significant things. You know, my mother's a social worker, so once upon a time, she read some research that someone that fathers relate to children differently than mothers. You know, I'll document it and the like. You know, the kids are it was pro father, so to speak. And even though they devote less time, they do a different. They provide different characteristics, different experiences. So my father afterwards, you know, my kamash on pshita. You know, of course, fathers relate differently, give different things, and so on and so forth. So I think you have to begin with the recognition that men and women are indeed different, and there's nothing wrong with that. And now, up to that, you know, I think you're in safe ground. And beyond that, of course, the question is: do you want to come and say, "Well, okay, since we're different, I'm glad to be what I am," and and now, of course, it does relate to mitzvot at the end. In other words, it does relate to the fact that Shosan Isha, presumably, you know, I mean, the Gemara doesn't, if I remember, the Gemara doesn't quite explain. The Gemara just says, you make three brachot. It doesn't explain it. But presumably, it revolves around the fact that men are chayav in more mitzvot. Now, that is a given. In other words, I think you can and you should make every effort to encourage women and girls and the like to have as fully religious experience as possible, including Kiyum Mitzvot and Talmud Torah. I also recognize certain limitations. In other words, I can provide them with almost all the experiences. A, I can't provide them with everything. B, there is a difference between Mitzvah Ve'osev and no Mitzvah Ve'osev. That is a given. So I think, yes, we should do everything to give them everything they can have. But there is a certain gap. Now, whether you want to say this is rooted in the differences, just simply the psychological, you know, or you want to claim it's metaphysics, that's an open question. I mean, Sefer Bereshit, if you want to say, almost offers conflicting perspectives on this. And if one perspective, Zachar and Kiyah bar Alta, if another perspective, and the woman is derived from the man, Chazal already pointed out the contradiction. The answer is no, the reconciliation is not 100% clear what they mean, what they're trying to tell us at the end of the day. But presumably there are differences in mitzvot. And so yes, in other words, I think, the brachas is stating something. Now that doesn't mean, and I don't want to get involved in apologetics now, apologetics even in the positive sense of the phrase. That doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, it may very well be compensated or achieved through other means. These brachot relay, the brachot have a gradation of chiyum mitzvot, and as such, they relate to chiyum mitzvot, and therefore, you know, you have to face it as it is. You know, if you have a problem with this, it's not with the bracha, the problem is the whole system. And I understand the feminists who come and say, you know, I reject the system, but, you know, if you're rough within, broadly speaking, I think a person needs a certain sneu towards the sidur and the like. So I understand why that, I understand that, but I disagree.
What factors should we consider before, when we're considering potentially staying here and continuing our lives in Israel, like right after high school versus later in life?
Look, it's an individual question. You know, it depends every person, his circumstances, his needs, his, you know, his family relationships, his obligations, his opportunities. I think you can give one correct answer for that. It depends. It really depends on many, many variables. B, there are advantages, like everything in life. There are advantages and disadvantages to both options. You know, staying immediately offers certain advantages, but also certain disadvantages, part of which are a function of the previous question. And the same holds true of coming later on. You can ask yourself, should you come at 24 or 34? Like everything in life, I think, you know, you can't give one answer. You have to have, you have to talk to someone whom you feel close to, who knows your circumstances, who you can explain, you know, your circumstances, and then consider what to do.
One is a halakha question. Do you always have to go to Iran? If not, which source material can you turn to, which is for Pesach, which is just source material that's on the way to Pesach? And how do you know to identify a question that has to be asked to Iran?
It's like this, broadly speaking, how would I say, it depends, A, on the gravity of the issue. In other words, I think, you know, it's legitimate for you, for instance, to pask him what to do, and in his tefillah question is doing the pasking and treifas question. If you have a question in infertility, it's different than pasking a question, you know, about, I know, but making tea and Shabbos. So the gravity of the question makes a difference. Number one. Number two, it depends. It also depends how confident you feel, and that's a function. A, what stage of your learning are you at? And B, how confident, you know, even given your stage, you know, how confident you feel in this particular question. In other words, obviously, if you want, I can give a formal formulation. If you want, any shaila you should ask a rav. The question always what's a shaila, right? In other words, can you eat potatoes with fish? So the answer is it's not a shaila. There's no, or to use halachic parlance, there's no limits of suffering. So it's not a shaila. So decide for yourself, or, you know, or open a book for yourself. On the other hand, can you eat potatoes that were in a pot that rubbed shoulders with a milchika pot, and now you want to eat it with hot fleshiks? Then you should ask a rav. That's a shaila already. So you have to decide here. In other words, what we consider shaila, because obviously, and with the rasof. In other words, if you have to ask everything a rav, so A, that'll be impossible. You know, it ruined your life, and certainly it ruined the Rav's life. and B, he'll diagnose with SOCD within a day. And so obviously you have to decide what's So A, it has to be something that you're in doubt. If you're in doubt, so now and you have reason to be in doubt. You know, so it's like this: a first cursory examine. So obviously you have the option of asking someone, you know, if you're standing next to, you know, if you have me standing next to a rav online in the chadar ochas, you just ask him on the spot and get the answer. But I think it's you within your rights, and it's legitimate to make a first, you know, just a first basic inspection: is there a shaila here or not? You know, is it obvious it's mutar, or is it problematic? Because it could be an area now. It could be an area that you're familiar with, and you know there's no problem, or you know there is a problem. Could be an area that you're unfamiliar, but you know you check in the basics, and you see immediately what's going on. If now there is a problem, so yeah, as I said before, I think you have to ask yourself: do you have the tools to solve the problem? And the tools are the following: A, the ability to learn the sugya, to arrive at the proper sources. B, now at times this is good enough, at times it isn't. Because there's a tradition of Psak. The tradition of Psak is both local and systemic. There's the local tradition, meaning, let's say you open it, you open it up and you discover it's Machlokes Shachtas. Or let's say Machlokes Magen Avraham Chasam Sofer. Now, there may very well be a certain minhag, got a pask in that shayla. Now, if you're a practicing Rav, you're worth a minhag. If you're not practicing Rav, you're just looking through the book, you end up, it's a draw. What do you do? Magen Avraham Chasam Sofer. But if you speak to your Rav, he knows, you know, what's Makubal. Secondly, there's also a Masorah de Psak, more general terms. How do you factor in Shasad Chak? How do you factor in the authority of an early posek versus a later posek? Do you take into consideration Rishonim, even though Shulchan Aruch paskens differently? There are many factors which are not, the same reason that a doctor has to learn about the whole body and can't only specialize, you know, in one particular organ. So too, the rule of the Rambam is that you can be samach davar echad, be tonight that you're right to be samach for kol Torah kula. So you have to know how the system works. So that's point number two. So A, you have to have the proper sources. B, you have to know what the Masorah de Psak is. C, you have to have the ability to arrive at a decision, not only you need a certain authority to decide. That's what I said before, it depends on the gravity of the issue. Some issues, either because they're prevalent or because they're not too severe, so you allow, anyone can paskin them. Other issues, they should be paskin only by Gdolei Ador, because they have a certain authority which they developed by passing thousands of shalots. A few years ago, I wrote Daf Kesher here about the Gerus issue. I wrote a whole thing. One of my complaints, my peas, if you want, was that so-and-so, I didn't think he should be setting down policy because he lacked the stature of a Gadol Ador in terms of Psak. To which one of his Talmidim who got insulted, responded, what difference does it make? How many court? Does it really make a difference whether you're passing 1,000 court commands or not in order to pass a Shaila that's such a Shaila? And my answer was, yes, it does make a difference. In other words, Rav Avadia Yosef can get away with a Psak that I cannot get away with. But virtue of the fact is passing 1,000 shaylas. I think the answer is absolutely yes. You grow in the position, and your stature, your shoulders expand by Psak. You develop greater authority. And the Chazon Ish could, if you want, by decree, could pass 1,000 shaylas that you can't, even though it's the same svara. So I think you have to factor all this together, and then say, of course, it depends. Before, whether you're Shana Aleph or Shana Tet, or whether you're 8th grade or a Kolonik, these things also be factored in. And at the end of the day, I think broadly speaking, if you feel comfort level, that you know what you're doing, you probably can pass it usually. If you don't feel comfort level, you shouldn't be telling them, if you don't feel comfortable, you shouldn't be passing it. You feel comfort level, unless you have too much self-confidence, but if not, in other words, it's like, what do you tell a young driver, you tell an 18-year-old with a new license, don't do anything that you're not confident in doing. If you're scared when you're doing it, you shouldn't be doing it. If you feel confident, you should be driving that road. If you're here to stay in the road, when you're driving the road, you shouldn't be on the road to begin with. So, broadly speaking, the same thing.
What?
Groups have expanded, and
I don't think the fact that the people, that the average people leave once my wife doesn't know who he was, this means this is a closer to actual group. There's nothing wrong with it being a closer group. That doesn't bother me per se. Someone when Shulzan was nifter was much more. Than, someone when I do my Ariv, it's a very nice piece. He wrote, I would like to know who this person was. 20,000 people felt it worthwhile to spend the day going to his funeral and taking off from work. And it was more like, you know, he must have been a very fascinating person for some people to be drawn to his funeral. So now, nevertheless, the reason of Israeli society is unfortunately you don't need a funeral to hide them. There's certainly the problem is not the figure. The problem is society is polarized. Now, once more to try to calm things down, there's certain, it's a good sign, it's also a good sign in a sense. If part of the reason the states or outside, you don't have all of this, plus three, because the unaffiliated disappeared, they assimilate. In other words, you know, to put it differently, you got fights within the family. You know, it's when did the fight stop? When the family scattered, when it disbanded. As long as you're in the family, so you fight. If you fight with your siblings, you know, when you're 10, 15 on the same table. When you're, you know, when you're 50 or 60 or 70, if you still across relationships, you fight occasionally. But if you simply, you know, and just, you know, you've lost touch, there's no communication, there's no fighting. Because fighting is always a sense you kill what the other guy thinks. And it bothers the Chilonim what the Haredi think about them, and vice versa. So there is, of course, it's also because of the fact that we live in the same house, they live in the same country, but which also makes tensions worse. But it's also probably what's understandable. When you're in the same house, and you're living together, each one influences the other's lives, to be expected is more friction. Once more, if you look at the States, so you know, if you want to be near the, if you want to be near the Haredi, you know, go to New Mexico. But over here you can't, you know, because over here the legal system and society, everyone's together. So in that regard, the polarization is also, in a sense, it's comforting. It's also for certain, because at the end of the day, there is a huge amount of tension. But the basic problem is that the tension is done by the, it's not the figure. The tension is inherent in the whole group. So it's different beliefs. I think it's an inherent tension within the whole system of having Haredim and Chilonim living together and working towards a common historical enterprise. Sooner or later, it's going to come apart. I think we did last year at some point. The reason things are coming behind the scenes, because it was an artificial connection to begin with. You know, they patched over certain differences in the first stage, which inevitably would sooner or later would crop up. That's what's happened. You know, this was almost built into the system when they decided to do Tzionut together. And it's simply the logical outcome of different groups with different ideologies and different opinions stuck together and working together, so later it will come apart. It's rooted in the system. Figures can make things worse or better. The problem at the moment is that society here, like unfortunately many other places, well, there's no leader, I don't see anyone who's head and shoulders by everybody else. And various the polarizing forces, the centrifugal forces, if you want, are powerful. The press, the political parties, like to emphasize the sensational or the dividing. When people on the extremes fight, it benefits both of them. It's when the Haredi and the left and the Chilonim on the extreme left fight, so both of them are able to prove their constituencies that they exist for a reason. When Tommy Lapid, he's not alive anymore, but when his character fight with the Troika, he can then go and raise more money and Zokin Shinuli. So you're the promising forces that was built in, those moderation requires give up. Now he's a figure dear believer. You really believe in these values, you really think of the cardinal values. To override them because of some amorphous benefit of shalom was difficult. I have my emet, and it's very difficult to override these things for a greater value. And it happens all the time. So I think it's wrong. I've been in Agadotim Giyot, I've been talking about this the past month or so. But that's the dynamic. At the moment, I don't know. I can't off the top of my head think of any particular figure. I think it has to be done by a lot of, if you want, maybe not one, super leader, but maybe many, if not top echelon, maybe middle, high echelon, much more local leadership. In other words, if every group will have its leader who's trying to calm things down, things will be better off. Tough, in other words, I think about the room. Say something for next. Okay, last we said. You're going back, huh? You're going back or you're staying? Okay, so we'll take your question as we say.
What would the being involved or participating in societal events or activities such as the Mavak Alim Mansaba?
Mavak what?
The events protest.
Ah, oh, I'll leave you in the same thing.
And should Bakura be involved with that?
The two, I won't really answer, I'll just give you a sentence or two. No, number one is, there's one question, of course, about each particular ma'avak. In other words, to identify with this or with that, I'm not going to get into that. No, I'm not going to start saying, this is a good ma'avak, it's a bad ma'avak, etc. You have to go each one. The Olim is one thing, and for Yudav Shomer is something else, and for the Ma'achazim is a third demonstration, and for women is a fifth demonstration. You can go on and on with all these demonstrations. So you have to decide which ones you believe in, etc. You have to decide how crucial it is. Broadly speaking, but also the question is, if you're talking about Bechor Yeshiva, the question is what frequency, and what cheshbon. This famous Yerushalmi that we quote every year when we talk about Yitna Dvut, one of the Moraim sent his child to study Yeshiva, I forget, in Tveria, from Tzipori to Tveria, vice versa. And he came with there to visit him, he came a parent to visit his child. He discovered he was volunteering at a funeral or whatever. And he was digging a grave or he was going to a funeral. The kid said, he wasn't making midrash, he was out doing it. She said to him, Hami bli en karim b'tzipari, shtachnichol, it's very I didn't send to Yeshua to volunteer, why did you come to Johannesburg to volunteer over here? Go volunteer in Johannesburg. That was basically his answer, I sent you to learn, I didn't send you to go and do b'nut chesed. We don't subscribe to that adasov. It's a question here of balance. And your question really is, should we be doing hitnadvut? How should we balance this? And I think your alim is no different than going in hitnadvut and the like. It's a question of balancing them. Obviously, the best is do matzah Shabbos, right? Or at other times, when you're off, you can combine the two. So you get to see the land, you get to meet Israelis, and you don't have to do Bidu Torah, you're saying do Matzah Shabbos also. And so talk to the girls on the scene. Balance them. What's more, beyond this, you have to balance each case individually. And you should be going to too many afghanos, which will disrupt your learning qualitatively. If it's a quantitative question, you have to judge each one, how valuable it is. But also, one last comment. You should always judge also how effective it would be. In other words, there is an idea that, okay, it's important for me to express my opinion even though it's ineffective. But I do think, beyond a certain price, you have to ask yourself, if you believe that you can really do something, for example, I believe it was a different cheshbon to demonstrate for Soviet Jewry in New York than in Tel Aviv. Why? Because so Tel Aviv has certain value in terms of developing empathy and the like. But at the end of the day, the Russians didn't care what went on in Tel Aviv, and they cared very much what went on in New York. So you have to ask yourself also, how effective will it be, and how much you feel you'll be able to mashpia. On the other hand, to demonstrate for you, Yehuda Shomron in here makes much more sense than to do in Long Island, because, much more, it's a question of
what, how effective it is also. But there's a very general broad outlines. So, talk to you next time.